Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, today's speaker is Steve O'Neill, and the title of his talk is Organizing People in Your Church and Neighborhood. So let's listen in on Steve O'Neill.
I start talking about organizing by talking about the first organizer, at least in Judeo-Christian history, and that is Moses. I'm reading from the Good News Bible. This is very short recap. Okay, you brought something to read. So. And a lot of people have not looked at Moses as an organizer, but Moses started off at least part of his illustrious career first as a union organizer, which, as you might recall, he didn't do too well at. Moses. He came upon a couple of Hebrews that were being really overworked by their Egyptian foreman, and he was being quite cruel to them. And so what did Moses do? He went and killed the Egyptian. Remember that story in Exodus 2? And instead of those guys saying, "Hey, great job, thanks for helping us out, you got that bad guy off our back," they were scared of Moses. They were afraid that he might kill them if they said the wrong thing. But later Moses goes on. He's called by God, as many of us are, I think, to try to figure out ways in our communities, in our churches, that we can fight oppression, that we can work for social justice. And Moses is called by God, and as what happens to a lot of us, Moses really doesn't want the call. He doesn't think that he's the right guy. He thinks God's made a mistake this time, you know. Why me? I'm not the guy that you want. And he says here in Exodus 3, "I haven't indeed heard the cry of my people, and I see how the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now I am sending you to the king of Egypt so that you can lead my people out of his country." That's God speaking. "But Moses said to God, 'I'm nobody. How can I go to the king and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?' And later, then Moses answered the Lord, 'But suppose the Israelites do not believe me and they will not listen. What shall I say? What shall I do if they say they will not appear to me, that you will not appear to me?' And later on yet, 'But Moses said,'" he keeps doubting God here, "'No, Lord, don't send me. I've never been a good speaker. Never been to a Dale Carnegie course in my life. And I haven't become one since you began to speak to me. I'm a poor speaker. I'm slow and hesitant.' And the Lord said to him, 'Who gives this man his mouth? Who makes him deaf and dumb? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? It is I, the Lord. Now go, and I will help you to speak. I will tell you what you want to say.' But Moses answered, 'No, Lord, please send someone else.'" So, you know, he's very constant on that, right? At this time, the Lord becomes angry with Moses and says, "What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak very well. In fact, he is now coming to meet you and will be glad to see you. You can speak to him and tell him what I say. I will help both of you to speak, and I will tell you both what to do." So he does manage, as every good organizer, to get another person involved. And Aaron becomes involved, and he becomes a public speaker. But as we know, Moses is still that lead kind of organizer, leader in the community. And of course, I think you all know the rest of the story. But one of the things, if you go through that story, you'll see that not only has Moses become this kind of organizer leader for, you know, about a million people, more than a million people, but they devise a system of breaking the community into sections, almost like neighborhoods. Where there is a leader for each section, every 10 people, every 100 people, every 1,000 people. We might say an early day bureaucracy. But on the other hand, think of the monumental task of getting these people ready to leave someplace where they've been for hundreds of years, go out in a desert with little or no food or drink, and a lot of faith, right? And then survive that for many years. So he is a good example of someone who is very reluctant, very doubting of their skills, but does a great job in leading people, in fighting oppression and leading people out of an oppressive situation into a very just and promised land. So it is a good example. The other thing that I'd like to read briefly is from James. And I saw somewhere that Martin Luther, what did Martin Luther say about James?
He has much good to say about him.
No, he doesn't. But it's in here, so it must count, right? I thought he had it marked. Now, Martin didn't put... James 2. My brothers and sisters, what good is it for someone to say that they have faith if their actions do not prove it? Can that faith save them? Supposing there are brothers or sisters who need clothes and don't have enough to eat, what good is it in you saying to them, God bless you, keep warm and eat well, if you don't give them the necessity of life? So it is with faith. If it is alone and includes no actions, then it is dead. But someone will say, one person has faith, another has action. My answer is, show me how anyone can have faith without action. I will show you my faith by my actions. So that's a good verse in talking, I think, about community organizing. Because really community organizing is trying to act out that social justice gospel, you know, that we all read, that we all think about, that we reflect on, that we pray about. But if we don't do it, if we don't go into our communities and our churches, our neighborhoods, our workplaces, and we don't live it, we don't act it, then what's the value of it? What's the good of it? So on that note, I'd like to talk a little bit about organizing. A number of years ago, a fellow by the name of Saul Alinsky gets kind of credit as the father or the creator of American community organizing. There certainly are other influential people, most notably Jane Addams in Chicago back at the turn of the century. But I want to tell you just one quick story about Saul Alinsky. In his early days in Chicago, he organized, his second group was in the Woodlawn organization, the Woodlawn neighborhood, which is a very poor, almost entirely black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. And like any poor neighborhood, they were not getting their fair share of city services, of a variety of things, loans, federal money, on and on. And they wanted to meet with Mayor Daley to talk in particular about tearing down abandoned buildings in their neighborhood, and they had oodles of them. And these abandoned buildings would be places for gangs, for rats, for crime, for drug dealing, you know, and on and on. And the mayor didn't want to have anything to do with this group. And in fact, like any good power broker, he did not want to even acknowledge that they existed. Okay, I mean, you know, just nothing. And at any rate, they decided that they needed to get the mayor's attention. And they thought and they thought. And this was a coalition of a number of churches, mostly Baptist churches, but there was, you know, I'm sure a number of black Catholic, Lutheran, mainline Protestant churches in Woodlawn as well. And O'Hare International Airport, which most of you are familiar with, was kind of the mayor's pride and joy at that time. It had just opened a couple years before, you know, the busiest airport in the world and everything. It was, you know, this modern, beautiful airport. And the mayor was very proud of it. And in fact, they just opened within the year, and they were having some big grand opening kind of thing. And Alinsky, the organizer, and this group of people in churches decided that they would do a demonstration at the airport. But it wouldn't be a traditional demonstration like you and I might think of off the top of our heads. It would be very unique. In order to kind of immobilize the airport, to completely tie it up, what might you think they'd do? And if you know, Brian, you can't say.
Walk out on the runway.
That would be, but that would be instant arrest. And I don't know if these folks were ready for arrest. And it could be dangerous. That would be instant arrest too.
Yeah, but
and dangerous to others.
Yeah. stopping the people from getting into the airport?
Yeah, well, you're getting closer.
Organize a strike in the, some of the workers.
Yeah, but how would they, how would the workers relate to this poor black neighborhood in Woodlawn?
Clogged up the entrances and exits?
Well, you're getting closer now. What they did is they decided that they would take over the toilets. Now, there aren't that many toilets in an airport. I mean, there's enough. You know, there's enough for the people coming and going. You know, and people do, they come and go in airports, right? All right, that was a pun. That was a pun. But at any rate, so, now, like any good Baptist church in particular, but I know a lot of Lutheran churches and other churches have these, they have buses, right? They take people to places. They pick up people to go to church and everything. So, on this particular Saturday, they loaded up these buses full of people at church on their way out to the airport. Well, now they, in kind of the spirit of nonviolence and honesty, they told the mayor that they were going to do this. This was coming. And they loaded up their buses, and the mayor must have had folks there, and you know, when they saw hundreds of people getting on these buses to have the first big, what they called, crap in, they decided that they were not going to risk this, because this would have made things very embarrassing for the mayor, right? It would have put him on the spot, so to speak. So, so the mayor was willing to meet with them. They had a very productive meeting, and they were able to get some of what they wanted. But it's an example, and you know, albeit a hilarious one in some ways, where people organizing could bring tremendous strength and power by having a number of people at the right place at the right time, kind of getting the right focus, okay? And they were able to do it. There's countless other examples of that, but I think the point that Alinsky made and other organizers have made over the years is that in organizing, what we need to do is organize lots of people, kind of like this shirt. And in getting those people together, we will gain power. There's two ways to gain power. Organizing money or organizing people. In the United States, that's about it. I mean, you can kind of think about other ways, but if you boil them all down, they generally come to those two ways, money or power. And since most folks don't have a lot of money, when you think about it, most people in the country, most of the people that we live and deal with and work with don't have a lot of money, probably the most effective way is to organize people. And in organizing people, we can gain power, we can gain strength. I'm kind of running through this pretty rapidly because I want to get to something we're going to do together. Now, power comes when people are willing to see that they have a common self-interest, a common bond, something that will pull them together, okay? Generally, we don't just join an organization, right, because we want to give power. I mean, how many of you have done that? You know, almost no one does it. I mean, there's a few people out there that are kind of power hungry, I suppose, and they might join organizations or groups for that reason. But most of us join organizations because we're concerned about something that organization stands for. We join a church for what reasons? Why do we join a church?
Fellowship, worship.
Okay. Because we need those things, right? You join a church because you want fellowship. You want to worship with others. Okay. What else? What other reasons would you join a church?
Spiritual growth.
Spiritual growth. Okay. And that you feel that you need other people to be able to do that. Right. Okay. Why would you join an organization? Who belongs to an organization?
Networking.
Why do you want to network?
So that you have more sources of information and power and access.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who else?
You believe in the purpose of the organization.
Okay. Give us an example.
Whatever its cause is. The Red Cross, if you want to be involved with safety programs, that's a means to get involved.
Okay. Why would you join the Red Cross then?
Why?
Do you belong to the Red Cross?
I used to.
Okay. If you can recall then, why did you join the Red Cross?
Well, I want to get involved with safety program to teach water safety, to teach a small parish water safety. And they, in order to do that in an organized fashion, you need a certification.
Mm-hmm.
You go through the hierarchy. And you get certification and training and you go out.
Mm-hmm.
It's in an organized way to do it. Otherwise, it would be chaotic.
Okay. Well, let's go back another step. Why did you feel you needed that? Why did you feel like you wanted to be certified in water safety? And where do you think that interest came from?
I grew up in water.
Okay, you grew up in water. You liked water. Okay, had you ever witnessed a drowning? Were you concerned about?
Oh, yes.
About drowning or about that?
Not personally, I was concerned
about others. Okay, all right. Well, what we try to do in organizing is look for people's self-interest. And self-interest, by self-interest, I don't mean in a selfish way at all. Or that went out just walking. By self-interest, we try to really dig down, kind of like I was doing there, to figure out why it is someone is willing to act or willing to do something, or willing to commit themselves to something.
We feed the homeless in Olympia and we do it with teams. And our team in our church I joined, mm-hmm. maybe it's my mom needed another helper.
Mm-hmm.
But I do it now because I enjoy the comedy and the people that work to help feed the homeless.
Okay.
And then we go to these places afterwards and have dinner. Mm-hmm. I look forward to this.
Okay.
All right. But it's not, I don't think I did it for self-interest at the beginning.
Okay. Well, you didn't do it for maybe the obvious self-interest. But you did it, okay, you said you did it to help your mother.
Yes.
To be with your mother.
No, just
you love your mother?
Yes.
Does your mother love you?
Yes.
Okay. And the way you act on that love is to be with her,
to
do
her.
Things for her. To obey her. Great, beautiful. To obey her. So you had a self-interest in when she said, I want you to do this.
Yeah, but she wouldn't have been upset with me if I said no.
Okay, but she was pleased when you said yes.
I think so. She never called.
You like to please her, don't you?
Yes. But I don't think it was so. Oh, okay. But
I think you're looking at that narrow definition of self-interest. It's not selfish to be self-interested. Okay, it can be. It can be. You know, if you're self-interested in gaining lots of wealth, so you can buy a lot of fancy things, I suppose that's selfish. But if your self-interest is to gain salvation, which, you know, is probably all of our self-interest, right? If your self-interest is to love your mother and to be loved by your mother, that's a good self-interest, right? That's a healthy one.
Okay, but those two things are semi-given when you have, okay, keep talking.
Okay, let's go a little bit further. Now you like to do this. Now you like to do this because you eat at this Vietnamese diner that you like,
yes,
apparently.
Yes.
And you like the company,
yes.
Right? So you have, that's a real self-interest.
Yeah, we work very hard, though. I mean, it's not, well, you know, like Holden, you work very hard.
Yes. Right, yeah. But you have found a group of people,
yes,
that are doing some good,
yes,
that you like.
Yes.
Okay, that you get some satisfaction,
yes,
from. That's a self-interest, right?
Okay.
Okay. And, you know, kind of the frosting on the cake is, not only do you do this good work with them.
We serve 140 to 200 people dinner.
Uh-huh. Which you feel good about.
Yeah.
But then, on top of that, you know, you're able to do some socializing with some people that you really like.
Yes.
That apparently, if you felt you could find that group of people somewhere else without having to serve that dinner,
mm-hmm,
would you do it?
Well, I do see some of these people outside of this group. I mean, it's, uh-huh, not the only time I see these people. It's a whole different way of, I don't know. I mean, I like to do something for society, and that's something.
Okay.
All right.
Well, okay. Let's talk about that for a minute, because that's a good self-interest to dwell on for a minute. Why do we like to do something for society? Who else does the things for society? Anybody here?
Dare raise your hand.
Helping organize and run a community music school.
Okay. Why?
Mostly because my wife is a director. That's the only chance I get to see her.
Good self-interest. Very good self-interest. But what else? Are you a musician?
I dabble at it, yeah, I enjoy that.
You like it?
I like to share it, yeah.
Okay, you like to share it, you know. I mean, those are good self-interests, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, sometimes those self-interests are very obvious to us, but other times they aren't. But one of the key things about it is, like in both of these examples, I mean, as human beings, there's only so many things we can be involved with, right? There's only so many things that we can do, right? You can only go to so many soup kitchens, you know, in a given week or month or whatever, and you can only teach, you know, music at so many places. But not just that, when you go to your soup kitchen or you go to your music school, you probably have precluded something else in your life. You know, occasionally you have to say no to something else, right? And if we were to analyze that for a minute, we might be able to say the self-interest at this point in your life is greater to do what you're doing than to do those other things. But we all know that things change in our lives. That, you know, we grow, we evolve, we have different interests at different times in our lives. And at that time, we choose other things to do. We choose other self-interests, okay? Now, for example, we could list kind of all the good things that people could work on. You know, the homeless, music for kids, the environment, and so on. Does anybody think those are bad things? Why aren't you doing them all? Because we can't, right? We can't do them all. We have to make choices. And generally speaking, and even specifically, we make those choices based on our self-interest, okay? And again, I don't mean this in a selfish way. I mean, we kind of analyze, okay, I think I can be most effective at this, or I think that I will enjoy this most, or I think I can be with people that I want to be if I do this, or I think I can be in my mother's good graces if I do this. You know what I mean? We make those choices. In a sense, we make them every day. But when we commit ourselves to do some kind of significant action, join an organization that we're going to get involved with, that's a bigger choice, right? When we're starting to commit time, okay? I mean, you can think of it in the way you make your donations, your physical donations, too. But time really is more crucial and critical, okay? And in organizing, that's mostly what we want. We want people's time. We want to encourage and commit them to be part of what our vision is, what our issue is, what our concern is, and to share self-interest, similar self-interest, with a lot of different people. Because then, this self-interest, whatever it is, we will gain power by pulling all of us together, okay? The Sierra Club is a powerful environmental organization because it has, whatever, hundreds of thousands of members, right? If, you know, if it had 100 members or 1,000 members, it wouldn't be very powerful, right? I mean, they have some money, but it's not so much the money that makes them powerful. They got a lot of people, right? The NRA is a very powerful organization. You might not like the NRA, but they are very powerful, and they have done that again. It's not like their members are real wealthy necessarily. I'm sure they have some wealthy members. But they have done a magnificent job of organizing, okay? They pull together people who have a common self-interest, right? They want to have their gun, they want to be able to buy it whenever, you know, and so on, okay? And they have put together an agenda, a legislative agenda, that hooks those folks in to doing some action, to writing letters, to calling their congressperson, you know, all those things. The NRA is very, very skilled at that, okay? They've done a really good job. And when you look at it, again, you know, it's just pulling together a bunch of people who have a similar self-interest, and that self-interest is one of the primary ones in their life right now, okay? That's something they're really willing to act on and do something about. You know, how many people write letters to their congresspeople? Not many, you know, but lots of NRA members do, right? Part of the thing is with self-interest is we start to act on our self-interest within a given organization when we think that can be effective, when we think that it'll be useful, that will be useful, and that the end results will be useful. Most of us like to win, right? Or we like to be on winning teams, okay? And that's not to say that we don't do things that we think might not succeed. We all do that, and that's great. We should do those things. I've done tons of them. But I think the point is that, by and large, most of us as human beings like to think that our efforts are going to make a difference, right? And thus, when we start to think organizationally, we want our organization to succeed as well, right? We want that organization to carry out those self-interests and prevail, to see some signs of success, to see some signs of change, of victory. Okay, well, that gives you just a sense of kind of the underpinnings of organizing. I've sped through it. Any thoughts, questions?
I'm a little confused about the self-interest.
Okay.
Maybe I'm confusing it with semantically, but to me, there may be a lot of different reasons people join an organization.
Sure.
And it's more a common interest in the vision of that organization, it would seem, that's important to organizing than the interest, self-interest. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are just a limited number of mothers that may belong to the organization already to pull in their daughters. But yet, if the vision is there that commonly is shared by everyone, mm-hmm. that almost seems to be more important than the self-interest mm-hmm. In organizing the group. Similar with NRA, there may be a lot of different reasons people want to join the NRA,
yeah.
but the common vision of that seems to be held, and the success of that common vision of being able to own a million guns, that seems to be more important to organizing that than the self-interest of each individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't disagree with you totally, but I would say that generally speaking, though, when we're trying to organize people, we can go around and say our vision of the Sierra Club or the NRA is this, this, and this, and people intellectually might say, yeah, that sounds good. You know, I like that. I agree with that, but I'd have to say, in organizing, in actually meeting someone one-on-one, it's more finding that person's self-interest, personal self-interest, that's going to connect with joining that organization. It can be division, and for some people, that's why people join. But, you know, to go back to her, I mean, the vision of this soup kitchen, you know, where you work, is to feed hungry people, okay? But that's not necessarily why she joined that. I mean, you agreed with that vision, but if your mother hadn't asked you or convinced you or...
If our social action committee at church hadn't decided this was going to be one of the big things they're going to do, uh-huh. I wouldn't have gotten involved in it.
Uh-huh. I think, Steve, we have a semantic situation.
Sure.
Right? You just used the phrase that I was just thinking of. You used personal self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
I would have left out the word self,
mm-hmm.
personal interest.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're talking about is we get involved because we have personal interest in something. And I think the word self has a negative connotation
it does,
in our
right.
minds. So it's selfish or self-centered or that type of a connotation.
Right.
And I know you don't mean it that way.
Right.
But I just wonder if, you know, communication is semantic.
I'm willing to drop it.
But we do
I
get
satisfaction.
It's a personal satisfaction.
But I don't know, I see the self in it as being primary and incredibly important because what I've seen in working with various organizations and different advocacy programs where we're trying to represent an interest and need, that unless the individuals in that group really come to it from a personal and a self kind of interest in it, they don't have the staying power. They can as easily come and go. It's very easy to come and go. Whereas those who have that actual personal investment and that personal reason for being interested.
That's why you use the word personal.
Self. Oh, yeah, okay. I thought you meant personal as far as just sort of being interested in something rather than actually having had a personal situation
that brought you to. I feel more comfortable substituting the word personal instead of self.
Well, that is a matter of
semantics. It's a semantics, but
you know. I would say the need to have personal self or whatever you want to call it needs to be primary over a visionary because it's easy for anybody to say they can share a vision, but there again, it's easy to drop out too, unless you know that what comes, it's the self and the personal that brings that just incredible drive, that energy, that never goes. Ability to focus on what the real issue, the real need is. Others can say they think they understand the need and the issue, but probably don't really have that real power to do that unless they come from a personal, the self perspective.
Okay. Any other thoughts or questions? Okay. Well, now the question is, as leaders in our churches, in our neighborhoods, most all of you belong to some church. Let's kind of stick with that church-based model. There's a lot of different ways of community organizing, and some do it with churches and some do it without churches. Okay, but the fundamentals are the same. You have to build. You have to go out and meet people one-on-one. You have to try to link these common personal interests, self-interests. And then as you do that, you start to find issues or concerns that people have. An example of this, on the west side of Chicago, a friend of mine who's been organizing for many years was involved in a church-based group there. And a lot of crime in the neighborhood, a lot of drugs, miserable housing, on and on. And he was assigned a certain territory, okay, to go out and knock door to door and to try to get folks involved in building block clubs in the neighborhood. This is what the churches wanted him to do. They kind of assigned him as an organizer to do that. And he was pretty excited about it. He thought, you know, gosh, all these big issues, crime, drugs, housing, and so on. So he went out with this kind of mindset that, you know, there's the issues and I'm going to go out and I'm going to sell them. And he's talking to people about that vision, about, you know, we're an organization of churches that are going to make a change in this neighborhood, and we're concerned about crime, we're concerned about drugs, and we're concerned about housing, and we can make a difference. And people were very nice to him and very polite, but showed no interest to speak. Now, part of that was that people in this particular neighborhood, but this could have been almost anywhere, one, didn't believe it would work. You know, they just, who are you, who is this organization that's new to think that they can make a change in this neighborhood? This is a tough neighborhood, okay? This is Austin. And so he's kind of feeling a little deflated and, you know, a little upset with himself and with people. You know, he's frustrated with the people. And he gets to this woman and she says, well, you know, those are important issues and everything, but I'll tell you, the biggest problem in this neighborhood is shopping carts. You know, that grocery store down the block, they don't have those bars, you know, that keep people from removing the shopping carts from the store. And they take the shopping carts home with them, and then the kids are playing with them in the street. I'm running out and saving kids, you know, from getting hit by cars. The shopping carts, they wind up in my alley, they wind up in my yard. They're an eyesight, they're a nuisance, you know, and I think we gotta do something about it. Well, as you can imagine, this organizer is somewhat flabbergasted and not too excited, you know, about shopping carts. But if you look at that, you know, that kind of notion of personal self-interest, okay? I mean, she had housing, right? I don't know how she dealt with crimes. I mean, she was not a drug dealer or a user, so she was willing to kind of put that stuff aside as kind of the most important thing in her life, okay? But shopping carts were important to her. Well, my friend went on, kept door knocking, and, you know, kept up his same rap, okay? You know, crime, drugs, housing, and, you know, getting the same response.
Didn't add shopping carts to the list.
Pardon me?
I would have added shopping carts to the list if I had done it.
Good organizer. That's what he did. After a couple more houses, he started asking people, well, what do you think about all the shopping carts in the neighborhood? And people started agreeing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, they're a big problem. You know, that's, and it was something, it was immediate. It had just started happening. It was very specific, okay? And it was what we call in organizing actionable. Something you could do something about right now, right here, okay? Right. So he kept going, knocked on doors, found a number of people interested in them, went back to the first lady, said, you know, you're right. There's a lot of folks interested in shopping carts. Would you be willing to host a meeting next week at your house? She said, sure. They had a meeting at the house, 10, 15 people showed up. This is an inner city block, a lot of apartments and so on. 10, 15 people showed up. They talked about doing similar meetings on a couple adjacent blocks where the shopping cart problem was, you know, just as rampant. and again, you know, had a couple more block meetings, and then decided as their strategy that they would go and meet with the manager and or the owner of the store and say, hey, you know, we got these shopping carts, we're concerned about them, they're a pain, and they're an eyesore, they're dangerous, you know, and so on, and can we figure out some way of stopping this from happening? And this was a racially integrated neighborhood, black and white, but it was a neighborhood that was becoming more black. You know, the white folks were leaving. And the shopping, the store manager was a white guy, and he was not too happy about some of these black folks moving in. And when they met with him, he said, well, you know, this never happened until these people moved in the neighborhood. Tried to create a real division, you know, right on the spot. Fortunately, people saw through that and said, you know, that's not the issue. The issue is there's shopping carts in our neighborhood. We're concerned about them. Both black and white people are. We want to do something about them. One suggestion is you put those bars up. Oh, no, that costs a lot of money. It's a pain in the neck. It's an inconvenience, you know. And, you know, they suggested a couple other things, but you know, the guy would have none of it. No way. Went back, had another meeting, decided that what they would do is they would have a shopping cart parade. And they rounded up all the shopping carts they could find, and then they heisted a few. They just, as they went shopping, they walked out with a few, and they got a bunch of shopping carts. And so the next Saturday, they had this parade through the neighborhood, and they kind of collected up all the shopping carts that were in the neighborhood, and it was fun and everything. They get to the store, you know, they called the manager and told them they were coming, and the manager goes out and he's very upset, you know. You stole my shopping carts, you know. And he said, what do you mean? We rounded these up for you. You know, some of these have been in our alleys for a month or two, you know. And of course, some of them had, you know, they were rusty and so on. And he's very upset. He calls the police. The police comes. Right, stolen property. And the police come, and the manager gives his side of the story. And the folks say, well, you know, here's what we did, officer. We went around the neighborhood. We picked up all these shopping carts. You know they're out there. You know kids are playing in them. You know they're in the alley and they're an eyesore and so on. Policeman says, you know, you're right. And you know, he's not going to do anything to these folks, you know. It's, you know, there's 25, 30 people there, you know. And so at that point, the manager says, all right, maybe we can do something. Mm-hmm. And they're able to work on an agreement and put the post up, and so on. Now, you know, it seems like, you know, on one hand, it seems like common sense. Why wouldn't he do that? You know, it makes such good sense. But a lot of times people are just resistant to change, right? And they don't want to be confronted, you know? They don't want to be told that they should do something, right? But the point of the story really is that by going out and doing these kind of one-on-one meetings, okay, meeting people one-on-one where they were, finding out what their self-interest or personal interest was, what they were willing to actually do something about right here, right now, this person, this organizer, and then those leaders, particularly that one woman, were able to mobilize a group of people to take some action over the course of a few weeks, to follow through with it, and to succeed. Okay. Now at that point, they were much more willing and able and much more confident that they could go on to work on some of those other issues like crime, drugs, and housing. And that organization has grown to be a very significant, powerful organization in the city of Chicago, Organization for a Better Austin, OBA. And that organizer's gone on to be kind of a big shot in organizing. So you know, that gives you a sense of how people can do it. You know, starting at a very grassroots level on a very grassroots kind of issue. Now the question, and how we can get this all in the next half hour, is how we can go back to our churches, neighborhoods, communities, and do that same kind of thing, okay? There are a number of organizations out there right now doing this kind of work in some of the places that you live in. You know, I know there is in Seattle. I think there is in Nashville. There probably isn't in your town. But that's not to say that you couldn't organize something, that you couldn't get something started. And again, I can't stress this enough, that the way that we start in organizing is just with one person. You need to go out and try to get someone else connected to your vision and to the self-interest that you're concerned about. Be that housing, hunger, you know, whatever it is, the environment, highways, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of things that we're interested and concerned about, right? And as a good organizer or a good community leader, we want to look at what is that one thing that I'm most passionate about, that I'm most willing to commit some time and energy, not just, you know, for a week or two or a month or two, but maybe for the next year or two, okay? And most all of us have those things, you know, somewhere deep in there, or maybe not so deep. Maybe we've got them and we want to do something, but we're frustrated. You know, we have this kind of this frustration that leads to inaction. So the question is, how do we go out and get this first person? We do a one-on-one interview. And ideally, you do this one-on-one interview, and you might not connect with the first person that you talk to, but you're going to connect with somebody. You will find somebody that's interested. And when you do find that person, then you've got two people. And before long, as you can imagine, this is kind of the classic pyramid of organizing. You will have more people because you'll continue to do one-on-ones, as will these other folks, and that's how organization grows and prospers and how people make those kinds of connections, okay? Put very simply. That's how good organization grows. You know, now, there are other organizational models, but this is one based on a very personal kind of communication system. And what we've done in Duluth, for example, but cities all over the country have done this and are doing this, is about five, six years ago, an organizer took this model, it's called a church-based organizing model, and that's kind of the general thing that he comes out of. He was trained by the Gamaliel Foundation in Chicago, but the Industrial Areas Foundation out of New York does the same thing, as to another of many, many other organizations around the country, okay? And he started doing these one-on-ones with people in Duluth, okay? And a variety of folks, mostly related to churches, but also unions and small community organizations that were more focused on one issue, you know, the low-income organization, the women's organization, an environmental organization. He started doing these one-on-ones, and over the course of a year, he did about 500 of them. Okay. And out of that 500, he was able to gather about 20, 30 people who were really gung-ho about this. Okay. And those 20 or 30 people then started also doing those one-on-ones. Okay. Now, this might seem like a formidable task, and it is. And, you know, I'm not saying that this is for everybody. But most all of us are very capable of plugging in here somewhere, okay? We might not be the first person, but most all of us, you know, if we care passionately about some issue, if we're willing to communicate with somebody else, you know, we can plug into this kind of organizing model. And it does work very well in churches. And there's a lot of good reasons to do it in churches. One, about 42% of the people in the United States go to church regularly. And there's not much more of a bigger core of people out there, when you think about it, who are already kind of organized, right? You know, they already get a newsletter. They already go to some regular event or function. They already have some relationships with other people, okay? In churches, what do churches stand for?
Service.
Service. Community. They have those kinds of values, right? Now, they don't always act on it, right? In fact, some churches rarely do. but they all have, at least at their underpinnings, those kinds of values that preach to building community, relating to one another, building relationships, and working for social justice, right? So we have some important underpinnings, some shared vision there within those institutions, okay? Within churches, churches have respect, they have credibility in most communities, right? And in many cities, particularly big cities, there are churches that represent racial diversity. There aren't that many churches, unfortunately, that have racial diversity within themselves. But there are black churches, there are Latino churches, there are German churches, so on, right? And in pulling together a coalition or an organization of churches, you can pull in people who normally would not sit across the table from each other, working on the same common vision and goal. So there are a lot of good reasons for churches to be the avenue of this kind of organizing model. Now you might say, well, what do churches get out of it? I mean, maybe I've said some things hopefully the churches would feel they'd get out of it. But I can tell you, I've talked to a lot of ministers and priests, you know, just starting with that kind of scenario. And I said, well, what's in it for us? Seriously, I'm not kidding. And fortunately, there are some things. What are churches, you know, as church members, what are you concerned about in your church? What are some of the things you're concerned about for the health of your church, health and well-being?
That we don't, our couch peeled potatoes.
Okay.
That's when we work very hard at that. The church isn't somewhere you just come and sit at church on Sunday for.
Okay.
Our church is working very hard on that.
All right. That's great, you know, because a lot of churches aren't working that hard on that. But what's one of those kind of basic things about churches? What do we like to see about our church?
Growth.
Growth, right. If our church is losing membership, it's generally not a good sign, right? Or if it's, you know, just real stable. We want to see new people coming in, right? We want to see young people, right? We want to see a mix of people. And for a lot of churches, that's a problem, right? We know for the institutionally, you know, I know that the Lutheran newspaper out here says that all of the Lutheran, mainline Lutheran churches lost membership last year. Now, I don't know if that's just a one-year thing, but I know there's lots of churches, lots of places that are losing membership. I mean, there's other churches that are gaining, but we're concerned about growth, right? And generally, the sign of a healthy church is one that's growing, right? And that's vibrant and has life. I mean, why do you join a church, right? I mean, none of us would want to join a church that's dying, right? Mm-hmm. Unless we thought we could turn things around. So most of us, you know, I think have that feeling we want to join a church that's growing and healthy. And this kind of process, which we call a listening process, we call an outreach process. All of you are familiar with outreach processes. But this one's a little bit different, because what we do is we train people to be able to go out and do these one-on-one interviews, okay? And then they go out and do one-on-one interviews with just about everybody in the church. And it's a team of people. Ideally, you know, it's 20, 30, 40 people who will go out and do a one-on-one interview with people, and we find out what people's self-interests are, what their personal interests are, both for the church, for that institution. What is it they want to see in the church? What would cause them to become more involved in the church? Okay, what would be their, that how can we pull that personal interest out of them that says, I would be more involved if the church did this. You know, I would be more involved if I could do this within the church, okay? And then we also, because we're trying to build a broader organization, try to find out what it is those people's self-interest from more of a community-wide social justice perspective, okay? What is it that would get you involved in a bigger organization, okay? Now, through this process in Duluth, people identified three issues by going to about, we had about, I think initially about 15 churches and four or five different community groups involved, where the membership of those organizations, the church council, whatever, said, we'll join this group. It's called BOND, Broad-Based Organizing for New Duluth, okay? We'll join this organization, B-O-N-D. And we brought delegates together, several hundred delegates together, to vote on what issues people were concerned about. But those delegates first polled the members of their churches, and when they did it right, they did it in some kind of process like this, where they went out and actually did one-on-one process, not just, you know, a slip in the pew that says, you know, what's your top issue? Because those slips in the pew, you know, they're nice. I mean, it's nice to get kind of people's opinions. But most of us, you know, might say, well, in my opinion, the most important issue, you know, in my hometown is whatever. But would you work on it? Would you go to a meeting about it? You know, most of us wouldn't, you know. About 15% of the people in the United States are involved in some kind of community organization, some kind of opportunity that builds community, okay? By, you know, neighborhood kind of community, city-wide kind of community. So it's a pretty small percentage. And by involved, again, I mean, you know, regular attendance, you know. There's, I think, if you talk about sporadic attendance, you know, people who pay their dues, you know, then you can get it up to about 30-35%. But people who are really involved, you're talking about 15%, okay? You know, what you find in organizing is a very few people can make a big change, can really change a lot of things about our community. And some of you know that from your own personal experience. But at any rate, we had our first big meeting. We picked three issues: healthcare, education, and housing. And I just to tell you a little bit about the healthcare. This was about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. So before President Clinton, before all this talk about healthcare, you know, and health insurance and so on. But obviously the issue was there then too, right? There was a lot of people that did not have insurance, okay? And including in this group. This was a group, these churches tended to be middle income, working class, and moderate income churches, okay? So there were a fair amount of people within that group that did not have insurance, or if they had insurance, it was miserable insurance, or they were concerned they were going to lose their insurance. Okay, Duluth is not a very prosperous economic place, so a lot of employers don't have insurance. Okay, so people said, you know, we're concerned about health care coverage. You know, there's a lot of us that don't have health care. Okay, and we'd like to have it, and we don't know what to do about it. So they formed a task force, okay? And this task force met and, you know, deliberated and came up with a strategy of asking the big hospitals and the big clinics in Duluth. We have three big hospitals and several big clinics of doctors. If they would fund a healthcare access office, and this healthcare access office would be a place where people who did not have insurance could go and find out how they could get healthcare coverage. You know, could they go to some program from the state or federal government? Could they get help or assistance from a pool of doctors? Could they get help from a hospital? You know, and at any rate, after some negotiations, some back and forth and so on, you know, occasional confrontations, but not, you know, picketing or demonstrating or anything, just healthy meetings. And again, the hospitals and the clinics eventually took this seriously because there was a lot of people. You know, we invited representatives from the big hospitals and the big clinics to come to a meeting of 250 people. And these 250 people in a church said, we're concerned about health care coverage. Even though a lot of us here have insurance, we're concerned about it, you know, for other people in our churches or organizations, for our friends, for some of our other family members, and for some of us that we might not always have it. And they were able to convince the hospitals and these clinics to chip in about $50,000 to fund this healthcare office. And then they found a little bit of more money to supplement that. They hired a director, and they have done a magnificent job in providing healthcare coverage for hundreds of people a year that otherwise might not have had it, that otherwise might not have gone to get, you know, a surgery, to go see a doctor, you know, and so on. So it's been very successful. And through that, they develop a relationship with these doctors, you know, with the hospitals and so on. And they've been able to go back to their churches and back to these organizations and say, you know, here's something that we've done now, that, you know, that we've accomplished, that's going to help all of us in a variety of ways. So that's an example. You know, I have had to rush through it a little bit. But that shows how churches can go through this kind of process. And in a relatively short time, you know, this was a couple years, accomplished, you know, a significant goal that made a big difference for hundreds of people every year. The program is still going strong. The hospitals and clinics are still chipping in some money. They've found some other funding for the program as well. But there's many examples of church groups that have done this kind of organizing around a variety of issues. Questions? Thoughts?
What's the percentage do you think you have covered in Duluth now on healthcare?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that we would know that. You know, that nobody, I don't think, has done a good enough study to say.
But it's a user-friendly place they can go to find.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, so various, excuse me, social service programs, and even the hospitals. If somebody walks into St. Mary's or St. Luke's and says, I don't have any insurance, you know, I think that I'm going to need this, or, you know, I do need this, or whatever. Now St. Mary's and St. Luke's, they don't just have to deal with that, you know, kind of by themselves. They can call Tenley, you know, down at the healthcare office and say, we've got somebody here, we're going to send them down to you, okay? And they do. And then she works through this process and looks at all of the possible resources out there. And the hospitals now, in maybe a more organized fashion, split up what free and reduced health care coverage they're going to provide. Yes, do these pools of doctors, these clinics. In fact, there's a couple, there's a doctor from that is a regular Holden here that has been very helpful in that process. So I don't know the kind of the big.
No, I'm just curious because there's, I mean, some other communities might want to follow what you've done.
Mm-hmm. If you do, you know, I can give you an address.
Because I don't know if we're going to wait for Clinton. I mean, it's.
Well, it's not just him. We've got to get Congress, too.
The state of Washington doing some good things.
Yeah. In Minnesota is, too. But, it, you know, there's still a lot of people that aren't covered.
If your premise is that you organize based upon individuals' interests, and you identify that interest,
mm-hmm.
don't you almost create a self-destructive organization? Because if these people are so motivated because of that peculiar interest in one topic,
mm-hmm.
how do you make the jump then to continue the program for other interests?
Sure, that's a good question.
You suggested that may kind of build on itself, people realize it's successful, but yet your premise is that you're getting these people together because they have this common interest.
Mm-hmm.
And once you satisfy that common interest, how do you keep it going for other issues that are important
mm-hmm.
For the community?
Right.
For the
good question. Well, I would say you do lose a significant percentage of people. You know, so for example, when this healthcare issue was resolved, you know, we got this program set up and so on, some people then said, great, you know, that's why I've come to these meetings, that's why I was on this task force, and we've won. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Bond. Adios. Right. Some people will do that, absolutely. But I think there's two things that happen. I think that one, some people start to develop a kind of a self-interest in that common vision of more social justice in general. You know, how can we make this a better community? And now they've seen a process that works, that's successful, and they've participated in that process. You know, some people like to be in the limelight, right? They like to be on that negotiating table, you know, with those doctors and hospital administrators and say, you know, here's what we need and we want you to help us provide it. And so when they see that they could be successful in that, some of them then say, you know, You know, I felt pretty darn good about that. You know, and I like these people, and I like going out to this Vietnamese restaurant afterwards. You know, and you know what I mean? I mean, you develop certain social...
Well, Patty Murray is now a senator for the state because of this.
Yeah, that's right. Patty really comes out of that whole network, right. Paul Wellstone in Minnesota, same stuff. Came out of a lot of community organizing.
Started Community College. Mm-hmm. Nowhere for the kids to go, so you organized this.
Right. Yeah.
Good. I think what people have to be conscious about with that is that when you start getting that transference on and on, is that those particular individuals may not truly have the knowledge of the real causes, the real issues at hand, and mm-hmm. here again they may think they're representing, but then they lose sight of that. And it's always, to my way of thinking, important to make sure that if quite a few involved who really are very personally aware of what the real issues are,
absolutely,
at least can convey that.
Right.
Perhaps then you can.
And I think there's two ways that organizations do that, these kind of organizations. One is, you know, they're continuing to do these one-on-ones, okay, both with new people, and eventually you start to repeat that process, okay? And then two, you have these regular meetings, you know, they might only be quarterly, they might be semi-annually, where delegates from the organization get together and they decide, you know, so you might have people that come out, you know, and have this sense like you're talking about, that, you know, they like to be in these positions, but they're going to be held accountable by the folks in the organization. And if the organization, if the people in the organization say, now we want to work on, you know, stopping this highway from being built, and even though that might not be the passion of the leadership, if the leadership, you know, wants the organization to go on and prosper and grow.